You're listening to Worldview from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jerome McDonnell. In 1969, Abraham George, a former military officer in India, arrived in America with $8 in his pocket. He's now chairman at eMedics Online, a medical diagnostic software company in New Jersey, but he spends much of his time directing the George Foundation, an NGO he launched in 1995. The George Foundation is dedicated to social reform and development. It focuses on women's empowerment, healthcare, environmental health, and a free press. Through the George Foundation, Abraham used his own funds to establish a world-class boarding school called Shanti Bhavan, or Haven of Peace. His goal is to bring an educational opportunity usually reserved only for the rich to some of the most impoverished children of India. Several times a year, Abraham shuttles between Bangalore, India, and New Jersey. He's the author of the book, India Untouched, The Forgotten Face of Rural Poverty, and Abraham George will take part this Saturday in a conference entitled Rural Development, Challenges and Opportunities, Identifying Strategies for Rural Development in the 21st Century India. The conference is sponsored by the India Development Service, and I asked Abraham George what made him branch out from the business world in order to help impoverished people in India.
Well, I've been a businessman here in the United States for almost 25, 30 years. And I had this idea all along that I must spend some part of my life working on poverty and issues of that kind. And when the time came along, I decided to return to India, spend half my time there and half my time here, and work on poverty-related matters.
And what was the first thing you decided to do? What did you first want to do?
Well, the idea that I had was that I should work with children from very poor backgrounds, the so-called untouchable children of India. They are called the Dalits in Indian terms. They are basically those who are below the poverty line. $1 a day is the income level that is defined as poverty. And the kind of children that I pick up, they are from families whose incomes are less than 50 cents a day, the family income I'm talking about. And the idea was that I would take them at a very early age of 4 years of age and give them world-class education. And hopefully, after they go through our program and then we support them at college level and so on, they will be successful individuals in the marketplace, in the global marketplace.
How did you decide where to go and what children to choose for this?
Well, choosing the children wasn't anything difficult. I had the clear idea that I want to work with children from very poor backgrounds and socially deprived backgrounds, the so-called lower castes and so on, the untouchable children, because they don't have the opportunity to go to any decent school. And because of their social underclass status, they are not even allowed to sit in a classroom, in a government-run classroom, along with the others in many situations. So the idea of picking up children from those types of backgrounds was very easy. The second part was, what should I be doing with them? And having spent a great part of my life here in the United States, the idea that we should offer opportunity, equal opportunity to everyone as far as we can, and that, you know, as far as I can do, I thought I should do just that, offer the very best in education to those children from poor backgrounds and give them a residential type of facility where you provide good boarding and meals and loving care and all the values that you can offer them. And hopefully they will grow up to be very, very successful individuals, professionals, and leaders of the society. That's precisely what I have tried to do.
And you started this school named Shanti Bhavan?
Yes, Shanti Bhavan.
And it houses over 300 children now, and it sounds like they stay there all year long. Like you said, they're there almost the full year. So it's in a way like a boarding school or something, and they really get immersed.
Yes, it's a boarding school.
And what was the idea behind that? How come they don't have them going back to their families and back and forth?
Right. Well, the families can visit once in every 3 months, and then the children go back home once in every 6 months for 2-3 weeks. But we have to understand the backgrounds from which they come. Think of a child, you know, 2 months after birth, sitting on top of a heap of garbage, and the mother putting the child on top of the garbage and looking for pieces of metal she could collect all day and sell it in the market for maybe 20 cents for a whole day's labor. You're talking about those types of families, or, you know, women whose husbands have gone and married somebody else, and women who have to be under the control of other men. And, you know, in a hut which is barely 6 feet by 6 feet or 6 feet by 10 feet, no kitchen, no bathroom, nothing of that kind. And men come and may have sex with the women, and the child is observing all these things. So their lives are a product of their economic and social deprivement. And the idea that somehow they could go back to this environment every day and then get back to school and they will be just fine isn't realistic. It's wonderful to be able to involve the parents, but the parents are totally uneducated, social underclass, economically deprived, and they may have 5-6 kids and they just aren't able to take care of them. So the boarding school idea is the only one that would work. And our effort is to educate the mother, or some cases mother and father, some cases no parents at all, educate them so that they would take care of the remaining children with them. But we take only one child per family so that we can spread the benefit to as many families as possible.
And this started a few years ago. How do you think it's worked out? Do you think families have seen their children grow and are going to end up seeing the benefit here?
It is unbelievable. Result that we are seeing. It's now 9 years since I started. You know, lots of people said that these are children who cannot be changed very much because of their backgrounds. For thousands of years, they have been deprived socially and economically, and they're genetically inferior and so on and so on. But I was totally convinced that, well, there might be some deprivation of the first 4 years of, you know, before they come to us. That might affect them, but if you offer a good environment, they are likely to succeed. And today, the children are going into 13, 14 years of age, and I see absolutely wonderful children growing up, both intellectually, you know, and academically doing extremely well, and also their social graces are just like anyone in a rich family who have been exposed to good environments, and their values are superior. They have an appreciation for small things that make a difference. They don't take anything for granted. So I'm extremely pleased, and I'm confident that even those children who may not do academically as well as some of the brightest children, they will still do well because of their ability to deal with people, their interpersonal skills, their values, their personal integrity and honesty, all those things that we spend a great deal of time and effort on. In a home-like environment. And I'm very, very confident that these children will go on to be successful leaders of the society.
You're listening to Worldview from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jerome McDonald, speaking with Abraham George. He's founder of the George Foundation. It runs development projects in India. He's the author of the book India Untouched, The Forgotten Face of Rural Poverty. And Abraham is going to speak this Saturday at a conference entitled Rural Development Challenges and Opportunities, Identifying Strategies for Rural Development in 21st Century India. The conference is sponsored by the India Development Service here. And what did you learn from your project there? What did you learn about development work that was different than what you imagined it to be?
You know, I have been quite perplexed as to why, after, you know, almost 50 years of, you know, sort of major effort to eradicate poverty around the world, there are more people in poverty today than, say, 25 years ago. By, say, the World Bank's definition of $2 a day, there are more people today in poverty. Why has it happened? And when I decided to sell all my businesses here in the United States, use my money and spend my wealth on programs, then I have to be very, very focused. I couldn't afford to throw away. It's not donor funds. It's my own money. So I decided to leave everything else, go there and work, create a team and work there. In the process, I learned a lot of things. 10 years have taught me a lot of lessons. The first lesson I learned is the idea that more money will solve the problem is not true. You know, the money is used, World Bank and government money is used, usually through the government agencies. You know, the corrupt governments and bureaucratic institutions aren't going to deliver the goods. The former Prime Minister of India, Rajiv Gandhi, once said that barely 15 cents to a dollar get to the poor. So 85 cents is going to the middlemen. And this type of programs, throwing more money, sure, more 15 cents to a dollar will go, but overall it's not going to make a great deal of impact.
I mean, this was primarily about governance in India? Is this...
This is true of almost every developing country. It varies from country to country. Some other countries in Africa are even more corrupt. For most part, the developing countries, the governance is not all that great. And hopefully changes will happen. But as of today, I doubt very much that any government-run program, more than 25 cents to a dollar in any country, goes to the poor.
And you had a story about your school, and you were trying to get a road built close to your school, and it sounds like it took quite a lot of convincing and actually money in the end of it.
Absolutely right. For almost 6-7 years, I tried to get the politicians and the bureaucrats to make a road, you know, a proper road to our projects. We run some 7 projects from school to hospitals to a women's empowerment program, farms, and so on. But, you know, and spending millions of dollars of private money. And yet the government wouldn't do it without bribing all these people. So I finally decided that I'll make use of a program whereby if you put down 25% of the money required for making the road by your own private money, then the government is forced to put in 75% of the money. But anyway, after a year and a half of effort, all I can say is that the 75% of it that the government put in, half of the money again went to the middlemen, the bureaucrats and so on, who dispersed the money. So between my 25% and another 30% or so, almost 50 cents to a dollar finally went into the project. That is a whole lot better than 15 or 20 cents to a dollar.
I stopped you on number one in lessons you'd learn, and good governance was what we were talking about. What's the other lesson?
Okay, the first lesson is that more money would not necessarily produce the result. The second is that government is not necessarily the solution. Or if you look at poverty eradication programs all around the world, it's a reliance on government programs. And NGOs are also supposed to be playing a part. Well, NGOs can do certain things quite well, that is, reduce the suffering, try and help very, very poor people get some relief, help out hospitals and so on. But NGOs are not equipped to deal with poverty alleviation, running projects and so on. And governments are corrupt. So what is the real solution? And my conclusion is that people like me who started NGO organization, but really working like a corporation. I've been a businessman all my life and run projects as though I'm a private entity, not for profit, but still running business enterprises. For example, we run a farm to empower women, to employ women. That is now the second largest banana farm in all of India, South India. We ship 25 tons of bananas and all the profits go back into poverty eradication programs. So the idea that government will somehow solve the problem is erroneous. I think private activity, economic activity, in a right way, where the private industries don't just exploit the poor, that's the second part of the lesson that I learned. And the third is that there is some kind of an assumption that poverty eradication, I mean, people can be taken out of poverty with small sums of money. For example, microcredit has now become a big, big buzzword in the developmental arena. $100 to a poor, and the poor person will somehow become an entrepreneur. And you know, the claim is made that all these women, especially, who have been given $100, they started their own businesses and they repaid their entire loan at 18% or 24% interest rate. If that was true, it would have been wonderful. As a businessman, I know that 1 in 100 businessmen succeed in the marketplace. So the idea that small amounts of money would solve the problem is not true. And there's only one way to do it. That is...
So more money doesn't work and a little money doesn't work.
It doesn't. Just doesn't. You know, you have to do it the good old way, the hard work. You have to create employment. You have to find ways where the poor can own an income-generating asset like land. And you have to train them. You have to provide credit. You have to help them market the produce. You have to improve the infrastructure. There is no easy solution to poverty eradication. Handouts won't do. Sure, if you give somebody $100 worth, sure, she can pay off the local moneylender who is charging you 50% and pay only 20% interest for the money she just received. Well, there is an economic benefit, but the way she pays back the money she got, $100, is going to be some government handout to her and she returns. So ultimately, it's a handout mechanism and it's not going to work either. So the idea has to be, how do you create economic activity? Government is not the solution. You have to bring the private industries to go into these rural sectors. In a way, they have to compete in the marketplace. They can be provide a certain incentives to move into the rural marketplace, but it should be for production, not necessarily trying to sell to the poor. There is a lot of talk about selling to the bottom of the pyramid. That idea that you're somehow going to sell a whole lot of items to the poor, that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for employment.
And it seems like rural employment is going to be primarily agriculture, which doesn't seem to cut it in our mindset. In this country, people are leaving their farms all the time. They don't want to be on the farms. They can't make a living there. But for rural poor in India, agriculture would be the answer?
Well, in the short term, agriculture and agriculture-related industries are the answer. Because first of all, you have to think of today's generation, men and women above, say, 18 or 20 and so on, who haven't gone to school, whose education is close to zero, the only skill they have is actually the skill, to work in the farm. And they have been laborers from very, very young age. And if you offer them the opportunity to grow, produce that are marketable worldwide, not necessarily as raw produce, but processed products. For example, now we are trying to grow not just bananas, but also grape, the vineyards. There's a huge demand for grapes in raw form as well as in, as wine and so on. And there's a shortage. These are things that they can grow. There are a whole other series of crops. Then you look at the health industry. You have health foods and alternate medicine and ginseng and a whole lot of other items. They are grown in the rural area. The processing can also take place in the villages. There'll be a lot of employment. And then look at the leather industry, the lumber industry, the pulp, and so on. So the opportunity exists for not necessarily wheat and rice, but a whole lot of other produce, fruits and vegetables and grain, and then process them in the rural sector itself where the rural employment can be increased. Don't forget that 2/3 of the people in the world live in the villages. In India alone, some 700 million people live in the villages. All this prosperity that you are talking about that is taking place from outsourcing and all the technology boom and so on is barely employing directly 3 to 5 million people in the IT sector, in the information technology sector, 3 to 5 million people today in a country of 1.1 billion people. Sure, there are trickle-down effects impacting some 100 million people, say 200 million, 300 million people in the urban sector. But what about the rest of the 1.1 billion people? You need to intervene directly. And in the longer run, of course, education and skills training. Children like this ones in our Shanti Bhavan school, provide them good education, which doesn't happen today. Then you can hope for things to change 15, 20 years from today.
And the Shanti Bhavan School is not so far outside of Bangalore, isn't it?
It's barely an hour and 15 minutes drive. You pass those glass towers of Indian companies and, multinationals, Microsoft, Oracle, name any company in the world, the leading company. It's right there in Bangalore. And you drive half an hour outside of the city, you are into slums. You are into those villages hundreds of years behind time.
What are some of the other projects you're proud of and glad that you did here with the George Project?
Well, I started with education, which is Shanti Bhavan, and then I decided that, this is a school for few children who are likely to be leaders of the society. But I must also spend time trying to improve government-run schools. So I started working in government-run schools, and I found out that on the average, for a primary school, there should be at least 5 teachers, for each grade. The average is 2.2 teachers. So you can imagine 1 or 2 or 3 grades combined together, and what kind of education can you offer? The toilets don't work and so on. So we have a program trying to improve government schools by putting in teachers, giving them books. But everybody is talking about digital divide, dumping computers at schools where there are no teachers. These are wonderful for corporations that want to sell their computers. And they are ornaments. They're for display. What you really need is bread and butter stuff. That is teachers, good teachers, teacher for each class, provide them the incentive to do very well, measure the performance, so on, and not dump computers in the name of closing the digital divide. Okay, so that's the second project. And the third one we got involved was healthcare. Doctors don't want to work in the villages because there is no money to be made by private practice. Those who move into the villages are not really qualified doctors, but people who want to practice medicine in an unethical way and make some money. So we got involved in rural hospitals, government-run hospitals, how to improve the quality of healthcare delivery. And we introduced management systems, expert systems for diagnosing diseases, many illnesses, even in the absence of a doctor, because most of the time doctors don't want to come. So a nurse should be able to diagnose diseases. And we have been able to do that. There's been a World Bank study and so on done by Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore that showed that it is possible to diagnose diseases even in the absence of a doctor for some of the so-called minor illnesses, some 300 of the common ailments that people suffer from most of the time. We run a hospital too, but a very interesting project which I'm so excited about today is the idea of income generation through employment, and second, providing the kind of savings from farming activity that would allow us to purchase land, a one-third acre of land per family of those who are employed. The project is farming. Today it is banana farming, but it's now being expanded to vineyard, grapes being grown in the area. Right now we have some 250 acres. We are going up to 500 acres of banana and grapes. The idea here is we employ women, extremely poor people, give them the skills because these are not easy crops to grow, but you can train them. In no time they learn these things, all the way from growing to marketing, and sell the produce by forcing buyers to compete in the marketplace. Normally, buyers would exploit the farmer. In our case, because we are now the second largest grower, we can impact prices. And the profit is put back into next year's crop. But if you grow these crops well, you can have very high margin. We run our hospital, we run our schools, partly the expenses funded through the farming. We are, of course, reaching out to people to help us expand these projects. I have put in most of the funds needed in the initial years, and it's not possible for me to do this on a larger scale without outside help. So that's a third or fourth project, whichever way you count it. And then I realized that the main problem with all these poverty in general is bad governance, and how will the citizens deal with bad governance? And I couldn't think of anything better than the media, a free and independent press that would uncover the abuses, the corruptive practices of the public and private sectors. So I decided to start a journalism school where I would turn out young people with the spirit of inquiry, who would go out and search the truth and write. And he worked out an arrangement with Columbia University in New York, and they helped us with establishing the curriculum. And today, it's the Indian Institute of Journalism in Bangalore is considered the best journalism school in India. Again, that's a nonprofit. So I'm taking a holistic approach to the problem: healthcare, education, empowerment of women, employment, journalism, and so on. So one may think, why is an NGO trying to do five things together? But my conclusion as a businessman, yes, it's like running a business, just that I'm not making any money, only losing money. If others would cooperate and help me, I think these projects can become models for dealing with poverty in a much, much more effective way than what is being done today.
Abraham George, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck in the future.
Thank you so much.
Abraham George is founder of the George Foundation. It's an NGO he launched in 1995, initially with his own funds. He's been successful in the software business in the U.S., and now Abraham shuttles between Bangalore, India, and New Jersey a few times a year. He's also the author of the book India Untouched, The Forgotten Face of Rural Poverty. And Abraham George will be in Chicago this Saturday at a conference entitled Rural Development, Challenges and Opportunities, Identifying Strategies for Rural Development in 21st Century India. The conference is sponsored by the India Development Service, and it's taking place Saturday at Loyola Medical Center in Maywood. We have more information about the conference and about the George Foundation On our website at chicagopublicradio.org/worldview, there you'll find links to information about all the things on India on today's program, chicagopublicradio.org/worldview. The cities of Casablanca, Morocco, and Chicago have a connection. We'll find out about it tomorrow on Chicago Public Radio's Worldview. Worldview is produced by Andrea Wenzel, Steve Bynum, and Dave McGuire. Thanks to Melanie Palmer for engineering. You can listen to any of our programs again on our website, chicagopublicradio.org/worldview. If you'd like to contact the staff of Worldview, send us an email. Our address is worldview@chicagopublicradio.org. That's worldview@chicagopublicradio.org. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you've been listening to Worldview from Chicago Public Radio.